Welcome to the 11KPW podcast on Looking to the Future, the HE and Research Bill by Harini Iyengar. This talk was given at the 11KPW Annual Education Conference for Schools and Universities on the 30th of November 2016. For more podcasts and information, please visit 11kpw.com.
Thank you. Now, you know that all barristers love a good fight. I had a fight to get this topic back because after I'd put my name down, a colleague decided that he fancied it. But I won. And the reason that I fought for it is that this is such an important and interesting topic. I've got three interests in it. The first is as a barrister who has an education practice. My second interest is as a governor of London Metropolitan University. And my third perspective on it is as an external trustee of Oxford University Student Union. So I'm going to focus on the law today, but this has got huge implications for all those three groups of people. The progress of the bill has been slow, which is unsurprising given the size of the task ahead. Some of you will be familiar with the Green Paper that came out in November 2015, and here we see the political jargon, fulfilling our potential, teaching excellence, social mobility, and student choice. Then following that consultation, we had the White Paper in May, Success as a Knowledge Economy, Teaching Excellence, Social Mobility, and Student Choice. Now, because of the speed at which things go in the higher education sector, in other words, those things which are to happen quite some time in the future need to be planned for now, obviously the universities have been poring over these documents at a stage when there were merely predictions and aspirations of the government, and universities have been making practical choices based on what's written there without knowing, in fact, how the legislation is really going to turn out. We've now got the technical consultation for year two of the TEF going on, and many decisions are being taken on the basis of speculation and anticipation. We're still waiting for the second reading of the bill in the House of Lords, which will take place next week. The government mission behind this big legislative change is said to be to boost social mobility, life chances, opportunity for all, and to enhance competitiveness and productivity in the economy. Now, since this all started off in 2015, obviously we've had the Brexit decision, and we've had several years of austerity, and I think the data is very clear that social mobility is something in the United Kingdom which has deteriorated in recent years. Hence the challenge to place onto universities the burden of improving social mobility and life chances based on higher education and what higher education can achieve for people, and to create opportunity for all. And especially post-Brexit, one might think that to enhance competitiveness and productivity of the economy is, again, a difficult task to put on the shoulders of universities and higher education providers. This is the biggest major legislative reform since 1992, and it's based on aspirations in the Conservative Manifesto of 2015 to increase innovation and flexibility of courses, to create value for money for students, to improve access to higher education, and to tackle skill shortages and graduate unemployment. And running alongside this change that's going on for higher education providers, we've obviously got what's happening with apprenticeships. And now what is actually going to happen is still uncertain. We're told that there are going to be 3 million new apprenticeships created, and that some of the providers who are in the higher education sector are going to be involved in creating those apprenticeships along with employers. But if you read the newspapers, you'll see there's been quite a lot of questions being asked as to what is this Institute for Apprenticeships doing. So really there's a major shake-up in all aspects of higher education and apprenticeships and education for this at this stage in people's education career. The government then translates these abstract concepts into certain buzzwords. And so one of these buzz phrases is transparency revolution. And they look at student choice and teaching excellence. Now, as you're probably familiar, teaching excellence framework is one of the major changes in this piece of legislation. And it's already well known as the TEF. And people use that term with differing degrees of affection and hatred. I'll come on to that in a bit more detail in a minute. There will be more new higher education providers, and the government's intention is that it will be easier to start up if you're a new provider. It will be easier to get degree awarding powers, and it will be easier to get university status. So obviously, if you are a university in somewhat challenging times, these are quite threatening ambitions that the government is setting out. And there will be the new office for students. And again, I've obviously got more to say about that in a minute. Probably the most radical part of this legislation is the introduction of financial incentives aimed at improving teaching quality, which is the TEF. I've already advised, even at the bill stage, I've advised a university on the TEF, drafted a letter before action and a judicial review claim, which fortunately didn't have to be used. And I think that shows the seriousness with which most universities are looking at the TEF. Even though it's not yet been enacted, it's got huge implications. It's very, very important for the reputation and standing of the universities. And yet they don't know quite how it's going to play out. We had a board meeting last night at London Metropolitan University in which we as governors had to decide whether or not we would like to participate in the TEF because at the voluntary stage. And I won't say any more about that. There's much still to be decided about how it will operate. One of the things that the universities have been very unhappy about is that in the original proposals, there were to be three levels of ranking, bronze, silver, and gold. And 60% of providers were expected to be at silver, and they felt that that was tarnishing their reputation from the very outset. And particularly internationally, to suggest that some universities had less than a gold standard would be damaging. I must say I have some sympathy with that. Logically, there can be three rankings. It's a little bit, as we sometimes pity our children, that you know, when most of us were doing our exams, if you got an A, you were excellent. Now we have to tell our children that an A is not quite excellent because some people have got an A star. So we're waiting to see what Hefke's going to do about this. I think they've said informally that it won't be, places won't be allocated on a bell curve. But obviously that, the whole intention of this is to create a ranking and then to have financial incentives based on that. In other words, according to how excellent your teaching provision is assessed, you will be able to charge fees. And if you don't meet certain standards, you will not be allowed to increase your university tuition fees in line with inflation. And if you meet certain standards, then you will have that option according to what standard you've reached. The NUS has been saying that they intend to boycott the TEF, I think primarily from the principled objection to any increase in tuition fees. And I think that's still under discussion. Some student unions are cooperating with the TEF because they think it will enhance the status of their degree afterwards to have their university ranked in the TEF. Other student unions are going to boycott the TEF completely, and other student unions are planning to sabotage the TEF, for example, in the National Student Survey, by giving deliberately zero scores or 100% scores. And the thing that's engaging the universities a lot as well is the new duty to publish rates of application, offer, acceptance and progression within the university by gender, ethnicity and socioeconomic background. And when you actually look at the bill as it's drafted at the moment, that duty comes out in a rather funny way, because it seems to me that the duty is simply to publish these pieces of information, and the bit that's energising people and maybe is hardest for higher education providers to control, the bottom bit, the gaps between these different groups, I think that that comes from the role of the Office for Students. So there's obviously going to be a lot of tension between the universities and the Office for Students, and I'll come on to those duties, which are very lengthy duties on the Office for Students. So the government's intention, the next phrase they use is shining a spotlight. Shining a spotlight on those that need to go further on social mobility. So putting issues of social mobility in the hands of the higher education providers, in a sense making it their challenge or their problem. And they intend to tackle that by creating transparency of data, comparison between rival institutions on those rankings, to give the students choice based on those rankings, funding consequences in response to the data and student choice, and I think what will be a dramatic change in the higher education marketplace. Now, the Office for Students, this is what the government calls smarter regulation. Many Hefke functions will transfer to the Office for Students, many Office for Fair Access functions as well, and this new body, Office for Students, is intended to be a champion of transparency and student choice. So really what we're seeing is capitalist market principles being applied quite aggressively into the higher education environment. And the government's premise is that with transparency, the consumers, the students, will be able to make decisions that suit them the best, and it will be their choice that then affects and determines the long-term success and failure of higher education institutions. The government intends to double the proportion of disadvantaged students by 2020, and that there should be a 20% increase in BME students by 2020. So these are quite ambitious targets, given the backdrop, which I've already mentioned, of several years of austerity and tough economic conditions exacerbated by the effect of Brexit. Now, I'm going to take you through this in some detail. The Office for Student must have regard to the duty to promote quality and greater choice and opportunities for students in the provision of higher education by English higher education providers, and then the need to encourage competition between English higher education providers in connection with the provision of higher education where competition is in the interests of students and employers. Then they must have regard to the need to promote value for money in the provision of higher education, and then have regard to the need to promote equality of opportunity in connection with access to and participation in higher education. And then they must have regard to the need to use the Office for Students' resources in an efficient, effective, and economic way. And then, so far as relevant, the principles of best regulatory practice, including transparency, accountability, proportionality, and consistency, and only targeting cases where action is needed. So it seems to me, as a barrister, that this is a gift to judicial review claimants who are unsatisfied with a state of affairs, be it higher education providers or other participants in the higher education system. There are so many terms here that can be argued over, if you like, a fight. There will then be guidance from the Secretary of State, which must protect academic freedom. And obviously we've had an interesting discussion of that today from Peter. And we've had an interesting discussion on freedom of expression from Nigel today, and must not be course specific. I think that guidance is going to be quite challenging to draft and to apply. There'll then be a new UK research and innovation body, which will combine the seven research councils, Innovate UK and HEFCE research and knowledge exchange functions. Innovate UK is to keep its name. So there'll be nine councils within the UKRI, and I haven't got time today to go into any further detail, but there are a lot of there's a lot of technical detail in this bill, which you always see in education legislation. The aim is to remove barriers to multi and interdisciplinary research by having them all under UKRI, and that there will be competitive grants alongside block grants. But obviously what all the universities and academics are asking themselves in the light of this is what is happening to EU funding, and it's a huge question for the higher education sector at the moment. So I think that there are huge financial implications for higher education providers implicit in this legislative change. In particular, the TEF standards. Very many big decisions for institutions to make about whether they want to participate in the TEF at all, because it's voluntary at the moment, but it gives an opportunity to do a dry run. Whether they can afford financially and in terms of reputation not to participate. And obviously, playing a game of chicken sometimes with rival institutions as to who will and won't take part in the TEF. And obviously then relations with the student body and how the student body's looking at the TEF. The aim of the government is to end up with a higher education market that is a real market with a big differentiation of fees in the sector and different rankings. And it's going to take several years for institutions to find their place within that new marketplace, and a lot of choices to be made, and many issues worth litigating about. Now, in conclusion, just taking a look at the practical implications. Well, I think that in terms of whether to, or not to participate in the TEF, whether to publish this data, whether to collect it, whether to move away from different kinds of monitoring data that you've already been collecting. And I think that most institutions have been collecting this data for a very long time. They're already acutely aware of attainment gaps between different groups amongst their students. They're acutely aware of who they're making offers to, what kind of people are applying, and what kind of patterns of success there are between different groups. I mean, just to take Oxford University, there's still a big attainment gap between male and female students, in spite of it being what might be, you know, generally regarded as a very privileged group. And if you look at A-level results as well, it's not borne out in the degree results. And even in a well-funded institution receiving students with very good A-level grades, these problems persist. And across the sector as a whole, there are many attainment gaps specific to the local demographic. For example, in certain institutions, the focus is now on white male students from a working-class background. So I think most providers are acutely aware of social mobility, and they're now asking themselves what it's in practice within their power to do to try and jump through the hoops that the government's now creating, and how, if they can't meet the standards that are being set for them, how they can continue to operate as best they can. All institutions are now competing for the best students in relation to the particular rival institutions that they have. We'll have to wait and see as to what new providers emerge. Obviously, it's not reassuring for existing institutions of higher education to have that uncertainty. In most organisations, student numbers are critical for financial stability. So it's already very much on the agenda. I understand there's a dip anyway in the national demographics of the people entering the typical age for going to university. So it's another pressure. The loss of EU students and international students, which we've heard about today, is again another pressure. And indeed, the potential loss of academic staff from the EU is another concern. And we're all just in this, as in across the whole economy, this is a sector that's waiting to see what the government plans to do. I have heard that LSE has indicated to all of their academic staff that if they are EU nationals and they now wish to apply for British citizenship, for which they're eligible, that LSE will pay for that. And I suppose from an employment point of view, if you can afford to do that, it's going to be very good for morale. But some institutions can't afford to do that. And as soon as you do that for staff, you have your EU and international students asking whether you could do it for them. And you now, in the current climate, have students asking questions about whether that's the proper use of their fees. If the university is to pay for immigration fees for staff. Another issue that I think most providers are acutely aware of is the hassle of collecting data for the National Student Survey. How well do they feel it allows an accurate assessment of the excellence of their institution to be made? How interested do they feel their students are in filling it in? What control do they have over it? What soft steps can they take to enhance their score? And I think under the TEF, there's some option for universities to put in a statement to accompany the data. And obviously, those who are in the voluntary trial will be sounding out over the next couple of years to what extent they can influence their score in that statement, which is limited to a few pages. And because of the society we live in, we do have these stubborn attainment gaps between different groups in society. And as I said, the scheme of this legislation puts many of those problems for this group of students into the hands of the higher education providers. And most institutions, I think, sincerely would like to reduce those attainment gaps. But as I said, to what extent are they going to be able to do that, given their own limitations and the job they do and the powers they have? So universities and higher education providers will be thinking about the influence of wider factors in society as they look very closely at what they're going to be rated on in the TEF and whether they've got difficult times ahead. So difficult times for higher education providers are busy times for us, and there will be many questions where a good lawyer's advice is going to be needed over the next few months and years.